So Keith Kluwer is our guest today. And Keith is a freelance journalist. He is the author of a very interesting and important blog at Discover magazine that's called Collide Escape, a clever pun that gets at how his blog is about colliding visions of landscape, of nature and humans. He's also a professor of journalism at New York University. He was for many years a senior editor at Audubon magazine, a contributor to science, to nature, climate change, other journals and magazines. He had several years ago had a mid-career sabbatical fellowship for journalists at the University of Colorado Boulder called the Scripps Environmental Journalism Fellowship. He was an undergraduate at SUNY in New York City and got a master's in environmental policy from the New Jersey Institute of Technology. As you all know, he's written he's well into a really interesting and important and controversial series of articles for Slate Magazine, all around different themes that we might group under the Anthropocene, that we might also group under ideas about new forms of environmentalism, or what Keith has called green moderns. Those have to do with GMOs, genetically modified organisms, nuclear power, new visions of conservation and environmentalism. And Keith is a real artist at provoking conversations, and then around those provocations, convening people and bringing in all kinds of interesting, important, thoughtful people, as well as the general readers, to those conversations. And he does it to enlarge the conversation, to bring more people into these important conversations. And he's working around the themes of the Anthropocene and those grand challenges that we spoke about in the first class. Climate change, urbanization, biodiversity and conservation, and sustainability in a world of great challenges and inequalities and the legitimate aspirations of many people. So I hope you'll join me in welcoming Keith Kluwer to class today. Once again, your comments and questions can come in person, or they can come on Twitter using our hashtag if you'd like. So, Keith, you know, I wonder if we could start with that question: what does the Anthropocene mean to you?
I think to put it as bluntly and as succinctly as I can put it, it means that there is no such thing anymore as a nature box and a people box. The discourse in environmentalism and so much of the discourse in environmental politics is sort of separated out. You know, the environment and humanity, and so the Anthropocene to me is sort of an acknowledgement. That dichotomy no longer applies, and that it's all mixed in, and now you know we're seeing obviously some serious impacts globally, of course, climate change being the big example today that everybody is keen on, but there's others certainly, and how are we going to address that? How are we going to address the changing the landscape changes, both locally, regionally, and globally? How are they going to be? What's the world going to look like? What do we want it to look like? And it's a whole new conversation. It's a whole new ballgame.
So So how has that changed, I mean, from you, for you, from the time that you were a senior editor at Audubon Magazine and moved out and began to create this kind of journalism and that you've been doing, convening these conversations? How has that changed how you see the role of the journalist and the role of environmental communications?
Well, the media landscape has changed since I was, you know, when I was at Audubon. I got there in 1999, and Twitter wasn't around then, Facebook wasn't around, and so magazines were still prominent. They're still prominent, but it means that we're operating in a sort of a different media landscape today, and so we have not only these new concepts like the Anthropocene, but it means that we have a sort of a sprawling media landscape to have these kinds of interesting debates. So for me, it's no longer about just writing, you know, example, no longer about commissioning a story, you know, about endangered species or about you know, how the Everglades are going to be restored. And reporting on that, it's now much more than that. It's, you know, there's a very vibrant dialogue happening around so many of these issues. So it's much richer for me personally speaking. It's not a static. I mean, to me, there really is a legitimate conversation going. It's not like, you know, I commission a story, we publish it, and then we move on to the next story, to the next problem. And we just keep coming back. We continue to sort of build on the conversations that we're having. So I actually like it a lot.
So how do you keep up? I mean, it also means that it's a never ending conversation. That, you know, I think, you know, you're blogging once a day. You're also writing articles for Slate and other places. You're getting these comments and reactions, some of which are pretty strongly worded, and that you have to respond to. So that, you know, I think you said you wake up every morning with, you know, a whole new batch of things and comments that you need to respond to.
It's not
how do you do it.
I wake up at 2 a.m. sometimes and say, "Oh, I better go check the blog," and then I'm not asleep again. I'm up for 2 hours, so it's hard. It really is hard to keep up. But if you really, I mean, it's one of those things. Like, I love what I do. I love journalism. I love conversing about these topics. So for me, it's, you know, obviously that makes it much easier. I'm interested in all these topics, so I like reading about them. So it's the journalist's job anyway to always keep up on what's happening, to read journals, you know, and magazines that are, you know, have related articles. But it is hard. You can get a little distracted, you know. Well,
yes. Ciara, there's in some of our readings. Talking about with articles no longer being commissioned, and blogging and social media being more popular ways for consumers to access their news and information, how do you personally feel about disinformation and polarization coming from that? Do you see that being a potential problem, and what are potential solutions?
Oh, well, that's a huge problem. It's actually a double-edged sword. I did mention before how, you know, it's a much richer environment for me to work in, to be able to have these sort of conversations that take on a very organic quality. You know, after I put an article out on Slate and I tweet it and then people respond on Twitter, or I put it on my blog with a little blurb and people comment on it. What happens then, sort of as you just indicated, is that there are very, very strongly held opinions response to what I just wrote, and that can overwhelm actually the content of the article and be very distracting to the conversation. And really, it's you have to sort of you got to tame it almost. I mean, you can't control what people are going to say or how people are going to read it into your piece or into a blog post, because everybody comes into it. You know, if I have, you know, 1,000 people read a post that I wrote in one day, let's say, I don't know, you know, on any given day, then, you know, who knows? Everyone's coming in with their own preconceptions and reading into that. So I can't, some of this you just can't control for, but then you can try to lasso it and then bring people together. As John said at the outset, what I really try to do is try to convene sort of a forum where people can kind of hash it out, and but do it in a civil manner. I don't always succeed. You know, it's a lot of snark, you know, online. And there's a lot of very firmly held, you know, ideological, politically motivated beliefs. And it's really hard to break through that. It's a challenge, definitely.
So talk about that some in relation to the piece that the students read from Slate about the green moderns, or the new, you know, the new environmentalism that, you know, got you into some pretty deep hot water.
Yes, there are a lot of people that are there are a lot of people in the environmental movement who didn't. I wouldn't say a lot. I don't know, but you know, I guess if I could distill the response,
there were some pretty strong responses.
Yeah, and, you know, and some of it was fair. I mean, I really try to be open to criticism. I mean, John will tell you. I mean, I really, when people, as long as they're not cursing me out, and people do that too, I'll retweet the criticism and I'll say, you know, or pay attention to this. I'm open to that, and I think that's what I want. If that's what I want other people to do, if I want people to be open to new ideas and new perspectives on these topics, then I feel like I should lead by example and I should be open. I should be open to their ideas as well. So how do you deal with it? It's just say, hey, you know, I'll read it. Sometimes I'll say I read it or I disagree. You know, so yeah, I have a Twitter conversation. I engage people. It's very hard to do in 160 characters, though. And that's sort of there's diminishing returns to that as well. I'll take it up. You know, what I'll do is I'll collect their responses, as I've often done previously to this. I will collect the responses on Twitter, and then I will put up a fresh blog post and say, well, and I'll sort of highlight what I thought were the thrust of some of the criticisms, and say, here's what you know, here's what some of the criticisms were of this piece, and then I try to address them in anew, and then build the conversation on top of what's already sort of taking place. Mm-hmm. I basically just try to keep it moving and keeping it advancing. You know, in journalism, there's the old adage is, you know, you want to, the idea, and when you pitch a story, if anyone goes into journalism, the editors always want to know, how are you going to advance the story? What are you pitching? Is what you're pitching today, is that advancing the story? Well, I'm sort of taking a little twist on that, and I'm trying to advance the conversation. That's really what I'm trying to do.
And by advancing the story, you mean adding something new to what we already know about.
Yes.
Know about it.
That's true.
My name is Clement. And in fact, you are speaking about a sort of revolution in journalism, because I think that traditionally a journalist has to like write everything in the article before being asked about some critical fact. Before being criticized, he has to write everything and being perfectly clear about everything. But if you say that you can update some things and bring some clarification, it's a sort of revolution in journalism.
Do I try to bring some resolution?
A revolution. I think you said it's a revolution in journalism.
Like it's completely new to update articles, to refer to the comments, to bring some new facts.
Yeah, there is a revolutionary aspect actually to what's happening in journalism. I mean, the medium is, you know, the profession is being remade, you know, on the fly. So we're all part of that experiment now.
So just to follow up on Clement's question, I mean, one of the things that strikes me about you, and I'm hoping that you can talk about this for students to, you know, to have this, and I think it's related, is that you have a lot of confidence. In part it's, I think, you know, born out of being confident that you're going to be in a conversation that's ongoing, but there's no longer the sort of need to have the confidence that you have the definitive report, maybe, before you publish it, but that you're open to revision. That's a huge kind of revolution in how we think about journalism, and in some cases how we're thinking about scholarship now, too, that we... You know, that we're open to that process of revision, but you still have a lot of confidence to stick your neck out. And what would you say to, you know, a room full of 44 students who are out there, you know, reporting on some of these very important issues, to feel confident in having that voice and becoming part of the conversation?
Well, before you, I will say that I built up some scar tissue, so that helps. Because you do get dinged a lot. I mean, there are a lot of people that have, you know, been dinging me over the years because of, you know, sort of trying to provoke these conversations. So they're not always, it's not always looked on so kindly by people that are, you know, have agendas. I think it just comes with age, to be honest with you. I mean, you just get to a point in your life where you feel, you know, you're at an okay place, and I don't know how to explain where that comes from. I'm just, you know, it just might come from the fact that I've been, you know, researching and reporting and writing about these topics now for a while, that, you know, I feel pretty confident in what I know and what I know of the arguments. You know what I mean? Because it's important to know what all the different arguments are and then how they get advanced. So I know what the arguments are, and I know a lot of the scholarship, and it goes along with it, and I know how to find the information that I need to find. So that helps.
So some traditional reporting, yeah. Journalists, you know the sources, you've talked to the people, you feel confident that you know the literature, and that you can write about it. But is there also kind of a confidence of knowing that, you know, you don't have to be right. You don't have to be 100% right if you're open to changing your mind.
Well, that's
and if you're open to being part of the conversation.
That's a big part of it. I don't know, you know, where, somehow along the line when I started blogging, you know, I made this sort of conscious decision. I think I started it in 2008, 2009, that I really wanted the blog to be, I wasn't trying to, you know, use my blog necessarily to persuade people of a view that they should have. I really thought of it as sort of I'm trying to interrogate ideas. And so what goes along with that is just accepting the fact that, you know, there may not be a hard and fast, you know, like right and wrong for some of these really sticky problems. And I'm not saying, you know, like obviously there are certain things that, you know, yes, global warming is real, but like what to do about it and certain things. I mean, there are people that are very, very strongly held, you know, views over that. So for me, it's about like just being willing to acknowledge that all the answers aren't out there. This is part of the journey, just trying to find, you know, what some of these paths or journeys are, answers are.
Okay, so my name is Raquel. Does it ever get frustrating, like the fact that the conversation never ends and that you're constantly looking for more? Do you ever come to a point when it's just like there's no point in doing this anymore?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
no,
how do you go about doing?
I move to a different subject. I mean, that's happened to me numerous times with climate change. I mean, I feel like there are times that I felt like I cannot write another word about climate change. I have heard everything there is to be heard about it. I've said everything there is to be said about it. And then, you know, I won't, like, touch it for a week or two. And then something will happen I'd like to play off what's happening in the daily conversation. There'll be a new study that comes out. Or some new controversy, you know, that gives me like, oh, an opening again. Like makes me like, oh, you know what? Maybe I can now go back to it and sort of like take another look at this. But sometimes you need to step away. Fatigue does set in, totally.
Hi, my name's Sophie. I was wondering, as far as starting a conversation, do you find that most of the people that are responding to you are willing to engage in a conversation, or firmly held in their own ideas?
Yeah, that's both, really. I think that it's sort of like the letters to the editors page, you know, on newspapers. You know, the people that write those letters to the editors are usually the ones that really very passionately care passionate about, like, that subject. You know, if it's gun control or if it's, educational reform, if it's global warming. It's sort of like that with conversations like that happen on Twitter and blogs. You get the most passionately engaged. And so you've got to always keep that in mind, that, you know, usually these are people that already have strongly held views. And in that case, what I'm really trying to do is just say, let's just talk. Let's just try to talk about it. And here's where I'm coming from. And here's where you're coming from, and can we at least find some common ground? I am often searching for some sort of common ground that we can all stand on. Because, again, I don't think you can persuade people, necessarily. I think we need to find commonalities. Especially, you know, these are very, very, emotionally charged issues. Climate change, GMOs. I mean, most people aren't going to change their minds.
So I'd also like to hear, we'll keep this conversation going and it takes some sort of, but if you have any thoughts about this article and the responses to it.
Hi, my name is Ellen. I'm just curious as to how you would respond to this article and
Chris Clark. I think he posted that. I read that critique several times on the Free Thought blog, right? On Chris Clark, I think he wrote a sort of a scathing response to it. And I accept it.
Farangula,
yeah. Which I've been attacked now by the way, P.Z. Myers has been ripping me to shreds the last few weeks because I have. Also, if you've looked at the blog, I've made this argument that science and religion can be compatible, and the really hardcore atheists, and the new atheist movement, don't agree with that. So I've been getting my head handed to me on that blog the last few weeks from both Chris and PZ. There's some things that I agree with Chris's argument. I don't agree with the tone with how he made it. I thought he was a little shrill. I very consciously have not responded to him yet, because I'm trying to figure out a way to do it that doesn't. I'm being honest, because I want to respond to what he says, but I don't want to be baited into just like, you know, so are you, that sort of like dynamic, and it's so hard, because when people really write these and write very personal things about you, like, how they're talking about. You idiot. How do you respond to that? But he made some points, too, that I want to respond to. And I think what Chris's argument speaks to the largest criticism that I've been receiving for the last 6 months, because this is not the first essay that I've made this point. I had this debate 6-9 months ago. And that criticism is I'm painting with too broad a brush. I'm indicting the whole environmental movement as being sort of like these woolly-headed hippies from the past, and they got to get with the 21st century, and I'll plead partially guilty to that. That is a rhetorical sort of strategy. I think I have painted a bit too broadly, and I'm really trying to think about how I can address that, Maybe I'll when I do get around to doing that, I think in the next couple of weeks, I'll send John a link to it, and he can share it with you guys. Because I think it's worth. I mean, there are some legitimate criticisms that I shouldn't put everybody in one box.
So I would just remind you that you can also post your observations or comments or questions on Twitter, and we'll look at them that way as well, if you'd like. There were some other. Any other? Yeah.
My name is Jennifer. So you said earlier you do your research, and other speakers have come in and they told us that they like research or subjects,
but
anything them on like YouTube, Facebook, like social media. How do you go about doing your scientific research? Do you talk to people?
How do I go
about
doing my what?
Like scientific research, like finding like science instead of like opinions or like.
Well, I'll read primary literature. Like, I think it's important to be able to read the studies. But you know, let's be honest. A lot of even science journalists. A lot of environmental reporters have a hard time understanding sometimes the jargon that comes along with science. So, you know, I do what every other reporter does, and that's you call up the researchers and you ask questions. In this day and age, that tends to take, it tends to be more an email. So if I have very specific questions, I will respond. Like I read, there's, just to give you an example, I was looking at John's latest issue of the Annals of the Association of American Geographers. There's a study in here that I'm really interested in writing about. It's called, Is Wildland Fire Increasing in Sagebrush Landscapes of the Western United States? I have written about forest policy and forest practices in the West. I would like to write about this, but I've read this now several times, and I'm not entirely clear I'm getting it all. So what I'm going to do is, you know, fortunately the researcher, the scientist, the geographer's emails pasted here. So I'm going to now send him some questions and say, hey, you know, I'd like to blog about this study at Discover. Can we have a conversation about it? Just so I'm clear on it. I want to make sure, I don't want to mischaracterize what's in this study. So I want to make sure I get it right. And that's the best way to do is go right to the source.
My name's Jesse, and just kind of play off that answer, I guess. How long do you wait for like a source response? What is your willingness to kind of, okay, they might have a very strong opinion and they don't even want to talk to you. What do you do?
You mean the someone like
sure.
A scientist? Yeah. Well, generally speaking, scientists, or if you're a journalist especially, they'll respond. Mm-hmm. I'm a pester. I mean, I tend to follow up. I feel like you can't just, you know, I'll send an email out, you know, tonight or tomorrow to him. And, you know, if I don't hear back within 24 hours, I'll follow up.
And then continue following up, or...
Yeah, I mean...
Is it generally they are helpful, but...
Yeah, I mean, again, this is for a blog. I'm not writing about this, so I'm going to be a little bit less... I'm going to be a little more casual here. So, you know, I'm not on a tight deadline. In the case, if I was an AP reporter and I was writing about the study, I would be sure to put in the email, I'm on a tight deadline. And can you please respond ASAP or by so-and-so? And you know what? They do. But I also, if I was writing about it for a traditional outlet, I would be contacting other scientists to speak to this study as well.
No. Okay. So, I would send an email, send another email, pick up the phone and make a call.
Yeah.
You know, it possibly show up, you know, if I really wanted it, you know, show up at the person's door or at their, you know, if we're talking about people, you know, who are accessible, perhaps, you know, UCLA folks you're trying to get in touch with, you know, find out when their office hours are, show up for their office hours, you know, and it does take persistence if you're not, you know, it's easy if you can call or, you know, send an email that has, you know, after your name, nytimes.com, or you can call and say, I'm from the New York Times. That tends to get your phone calls returned. But if you don't, you often have to be, you know, you have to be tenacious.
That's true. I do want to reiterate that I would, if I was writing this for, like, you know, the New York Times, you would be calling. I mean, I'd send an email first out just as a courtesy heads up. But then, yeah. But because it's a blog post, I'm taking a little bit of a more laid-back approach.
Yeah, and I also, I mean, I've kind of, I don't know how you all feel about this, and I know, but that, you know, I've noticed that students are sometimes reluctant to use the telephone. You know, because we're, you know, we use email and maybe texting so much, and, you know, that we've kind of forgotten there is this tool, you know, to get in touch with people.
I think just as a response to that, sometimes just in professional conversation or whatnot, calling someone isn't necessarily intimidating. It's just you don't want to bother them because you're not sure how to read the other person so well, and you don't want to be a bother. But I think that students don't realize that the email gets lost, and the next email gets lost, and then the phone call is not something that's going to get lost. We also don't want to bother someone who we consider more important.
Yeah, no, I have my cell phone is on the web. And, you know, when I was running a center at Stanford on the American West, I felt it was important to be available, particularly to be available to journalists who might be on deadline. And so my cell phone was on the web, and people would say, you know, wow, your phone is on the web. I'd maybe get 2 calls a year. and the first thing somebody would say, you know, I'm sorry to bother you. Is it okay to call on this number? And it's like, it's online. So Elizabeth,
I was going to follow up to that as well.
Yeah.
A lot of the departments at UCLA have been cutting their office phone lines.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So professors are often only reachable in person or by email.
Huh.
I don't know. How do you deal with something like that? How do you get in touch with people who are don't have access?
I'm gonna hand that one over to John. How do you get? I mean, if they're not giving their phone out,
I would just go to their office
and
you know try to find out if they have office hours,
yeah.
and just you know if you're going to do the kinds of things that we're going to be doing that you're going to be doing in this class, you know I think this is part of what I was to get at it in the confidence both of being confident of your own voices. And that's something, you know, I think, you know, Keith said it comes with age. I think it comes with practice too.
Yeah.
And it comes just with, it also comes just with doing it, you know, just do it and get out there and, you know, don't be afraid to write what you think, to say what you think, to feel confident about it. And I think the same goes with approaching people. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, you're doing something that's really worthwhile and important, and it is important. What you're doing is important too. These are important people, but what you're doing is important. So feel that you have, you know, you're perfectly right to ask politely for some attention. And if the person doesn't want to do it, you know, that's a different story. But oftentimes, once you make that connection, you'll work. And do you want to, Elizabeth, amplify on this question of, you know, how do you emphasize, communicate the facts within the environmental movement, since they are often, so often convoluted? And I wonder if you mean by convoluted, complex or complicated? Or
no, I mean, a lot of people take them and use them for their own agendas. So, whatever scientific study is done, whatever, the facts tend to be disembodied from the original research. How, say, as a consumer, do you identify, who is telling the truth is
but
do you find that that's an issue?
I think it definitely is an issue. I think it comes down to, you know, who your source is. As in my own class when I'm teaching journalism, that's a big part of when students are doing their research. I ask them, do you understand if you're looking up, you know, do you understand the where this think tank is coming from? Do you understand that Greenpeace maybe coming at an issue from a certain perspective, you know, if they're on nuclear power or genetically modified foods, or do you understand that that's an industry group? And so it's understanding the sources and being sophisticated about that. I do think that, you know, one of the best things that people could do today is just to become much more sophisticated consumers of news. Mm-hmm. You could really help yourselves out if you just, you know, it's not just about being, you know, science literate or you know, knowing, understanding. It's really understanding where the information is coming from, being able to sort of see through, you know, some, you know, just being able to really grasp the different arguments as well, not being beholden yourself to one view.
I'm Elizabeth. I have a question also about the readership in that sense. And so how do you, if journalism is moving towards things like Twitter or reading blogs or something like that, how do you target people that aren't
type of people that would follow your Twitter? Or so if Republicans are always maybe only following Fox News, how would a liberal person target that audience if it's not all just in one newspaper that everyone is going to read?
The way I personally go about it is I try to appeal to a broad spectrum. I consciously don't want to speak to the choir. I did that with Audubon at Audubon Magazine. I know who that audience was, even though there's a conservative element to that audience. I feel like if I have readers that are across the ideological and political spectrum, then often what they'll do is, because a lot of these readers have their own Twitter feeds and their own Tumblrs and Facebook accounts, what they'll do is, if somebody who may not share my own political beliefs but likes what I wrote, he or she will then share that post on their Facebook, or their whatever social media account, and it'll then sort of sprinkle out to that audience. And that's, at least that's what I'm hoping. Maybe I'm naive about it, but that's what I'm hoping. I mean, I'm thinking, based upon my Twitter feed, I'm guessing that some of the, views, the variedness of some of the people that follow me, I know I have people that belong to, Cato and Heritage, even though I wouldn't consider myself to be an ideological soul traveler. They follow me because they kind of respect me. And so I know that those views are getting out to that audience. By the same token, I know that there are other, there are various liberal think tanks that also follow, so who are open to what I write, and they'll post it and share it with their audience. So it gets out there. That's the beauty of social media. It does get out there. I just don't know what happens to it or if it has any impact.
My name is Lana.
I'm
a
good question. Wow, how can they collaborate to move forward? Well, I think it's going to happen with the insiders. I think people like Peter Kariba, who I believe is going to be speaking here in a month. Peter's a really highly respected ecologist and big insider in with the Nature Conservancy, and he's come out. And I named him in my story and quoted from him, and he's now challenging what I would consider some of the orthodox, perspectives or opinions of the movement he grew up in, the conservation movement. And so I think it's going to happen with people like him, people that are on the inside already, that are reaching across and saying, "Hey, let's do it. Let's see if we can do things a little differently." It's not easy. I mean, there's a lot of resistance to Peter. I'm sure he'll talk. He might even talk about that. But that's. I think it's going to happen with folks on the inside leading the way.
My name is Olivia, and kind of related to the previous question. Would you say that the two sides, on either side of the great schism that you're talking about in your article, would you say that is mostly an age thing, like people who are older tend to be more traditional conservationists or other factors?
It's a good question, too. I don't know if I considered that as much.
It would certainly look like it from the two pictures here, huh? Emma Maris and E.O. Wilson.
I think there's a good criticism. I think I linked to it by Michelle Nyas wrote. She did write, the conflict that happened that I sort of alluded to between E.O. Wilson and Emma Maris. Another science writer said it was generational. That that he is coming from a certain viewpoint that is really with us. It's really very sort of powerfully embedded in the worldview of an older generation, and then a newer generation maybe is not so wedded to that view. So yeah, there is a generational aspect to it. I think it's more complicated than that too.
So let me ask. I mean, and there's start by saying there's no right or wrong answer to this, okay? And you won't be graded on how you, certainly on how you answer this question. But if we were to take the, this schism that Keith identifies, how many of you would identify yourselves with the traditional environmental views, that nature needs to be protected from humans? Go ahead, raise your hands. I'm curious. wait, leave them up. Wait, I want to. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. Okay, so and how many would identify yourselves with what was the name? The new pragmatists or the modernist greens? Okay, one. Well, you're going to vote twice, huh? Okay, that's fair. That's fair. I might raise my hand at both of those, too, Okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. Yeah, and if it adds up to more than 100%, that's okay. Some of us identify both ways.
But should we identify what? I mean, I guess I'm curious.
I think.
I don't want to repeat what's already in there. But when you raise your hand as being aligned with the traditionalists, what do you think that means? What is a traditionalist environmentalist? Did I capture it correctly in the view, or did I unfairly indict it?
I said I was a traditionalist, but I think for me, I'm definitely open to kind of this new interpretation of environmentalism. I guess when reading your article, and maybe I might have missed something, I just sort of felt like with this modernist belief, it was almost like this is what our planet is doing. Humans are a good impact on the planet, and we sort of just have to deal with it. And I guess in my opinion, it just feels like if it's inevitable, I feel like I can't. So then I don't really like that.
So say your name.
Corey.
Okay.
I'm Mario. Going back to what you were saying, I'm sure in both groups there's also subgroups that are really polarized. So which ones do you pay attention to when you write an article such as this? Like the ones that sound more sensible or the ones who seem to really embrace it fully?
Well, that raises an issue, or another criticism that's been leveled at me is in that I'm sort of keying in on maybe an extreme, or that's not necessarily characteristic of where the environmentalism is today, and I want to address that. I don't think I can do it here yet. I'm still working through that, but I do believe and I do contend that in the discourse, in the popular discourse, as reflected in magazines. And in the metaphors that we use, that we still sort of hew to a traditionalist, mindset, in how we look at sustainability or environmental issues.
So of course, in journalism, controversy helps sell. Whether it's newspapers or magazines or blogs or TV and conflict has a way of sharpening differences, sharpening arguments and ideas, and so it can be useful, right? To get at what are the core disagreements that we should be thinking about. It's often why on an op-ed page, you'll have someone, for nuclear power, someone against, someone for GMOs, someone against, someone for gun control, someone against, it's that idea that through debate and disagreement and conflict, we can, it's a useful way to figure things out. And I think, that it's why, you'll hear me use the word argument as a good thing, But it can also be, you know, not that useful sometimes. And sometimes it's much more useful. And I think there are forms of journalism, of writing, you know, particularly often, you know, say an essay form or, you know, a feature or a profile that can get at a more complicated and nuanced view of how people think about particular issues that is not so, you know, black and white or dichotomous or conflicted.
John, can I address what Corey said, though?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to leave that hanging. It kind of bothers me when the implication is, well, it's sort of a fatalistic attitude, whereas, you know, you had mentioned, was it Corey?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. The idea of, well, if the world's changing, on such a sort of a drastic level, and these problems are so monumental, like climate change, well, what can we do about it? And, you know, the idea that, well, why should we care, or what can we do? I kind of think that's the wrong way. And certainly I wouldn't want people to walk away with that. I wouldn't be in this business if I thought, if that was the impression that I was leaving with people. I mean, basically, part of what I'm trying to do is just highlight how complicated these debates are, and that there is no silver bullet, there is no easy solution. And the last piece that I wrote for Slate on nuclear power, comparing nuclear power and renewable energy, you'll see that. If you look that one up and you have time, you'll see I work through the arguments for both of them and basically come to the conclusion that there really is nothing right now that is going to get us off fossil fuels tomorrow or the next day or next week or next year or maybe even the next few decades. But we need to still work to that. You know, make it happen. But I guess for me, bringing it back to the Anthropocene, I read quickly an article in this Momentum magazine by John Foley, who's the director of the counterpart of the school at University of Minnesota, is it? And he writes that he starts off his article. He's a thoughtful scientist as well. He writes, We are supposed to be in the business of changing the world. The question is, are we? And I think that speaks to what you said. I mean, are we changing the world? But I think that's, in the Anthropocene, I think that's the wrong question. I think the question should be, the world is changing, for sure. What do you want it to look like? What do we want it to look like? That's the question facing us in the Anthropocene. The world is changing. Forget it. That's happening. It always has, it always will. And it's happening on a crazy speeded up level now. But what do you want it to look like? And that's the debate. One of the big debates we should be having, you know, in the age of the Anthropocene. What do we want it to look like? And that comes down, honestly, doesn't come down to science, doesn't come down to facts, it comes down to culture, our worldviews. And that's why the title of my blog is called Kaleidoscape, because it's a collision of worldviews often. And can we come to some sort of can we mesh? Can we reconcile all of our competing worldviews over what the world should look like? You know, how it should be developed, and can we reconcile these views in a way that is that people have a say, and it's also done in obviously in a sustainable manner, the changes that we do make.
My name is Lena. Going off what you just said, do you think, everyone's obviously not going to pick one idea and say, okay, this is what we're doing, this is what we all decided on. Like, how is it going to change, between different cultures? Because obviously, Americans think different than the Swiss, and everyone's different. So what do you think, or can you see it going?
So, in other words, how do we reconcile the global aspect of this?
It's like the different cultures.
Well, for one thing, we could start by not being so American-centric. Honestly, I mean, we often think that we see these debates through the prism of our own culture, and our own ideas. So again, that this goes to just being open to other people have different ideas about how to get to the same place. I mean, that's what it comes down to with the nuclear and the renewable energy, right? I'm writing in that story about people that deeply and passionately care about climate change who, for that reason, like James Hansen, the top scientist, one of the top leading climate scientists, and Stuart Brand, one of the iconic environmentalists, really believe nuclear power is the way to go if you want to do something about climate change. There are other people just as strongly that feel very strongly about, you know, climate change that say, well, no, the best way to do it is really to ramp up, you know, solar and wind and efficiency. My position is neither one of them are really, you know, wrong, but can we reconcile it somehow so we can all work together? Sounds so like that.
So Alice. So you mentioned the competing worldviews, and you also mentioned the Mr. Clark, you know, who kind of has like criticism. So I know like you don't wanna like egg him on and you don't want to go into that, but I know that with all of our different worldviews and culture, of course, that we all have our own perspectives. Have you like personally ever had a time where story or connections that you're trying to follow up on that you felt sometimes you actually accidentally did cross that boundary because there's just so much like differences in people, of course, like, you know, you want to have that educated conversation, but sometimes you heat it so much that, you know, that, oh, sometimes you have to go all the way.
You mean do I take the bait?
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, it happens to me way more than I would like, to be honest. I mean, it's hard not to, especially in the moment, when you're in that moment and somebody fires a tweet at you, like, hey, asshole, how could you write that? You know? I mean, sometimes you just, like, you know, you're having a bad day and you just spill your coffee, like, yeah, you know, F you too, you know? It's hard. I'm human. I mean, I really try, but it's hard. You have to work hard to rise above it. But I'm often no better sometimes.
So Constantine here asks, I mean, what if any are the differences between the way that you write for Discover and for Slate?
Well, they're different audiences. Yeah, that's a good question. Well, Slate has a more general audience, you know, general readership, whereas Discover is, probably all know, it's science-based, you know. So, and I'm writing in two different types of forms. One, I'm writing an article for Slate, so it's got to cohere more. It's got to be a standalone piece. So it's got to have, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an ending, you know, and it's got to look like, you know, a traditional kind of, you know, journalistic essay or something. Whereas, you know, and I have to sort of bear in mind that not everybody's going to have the same depth of knowledge. Whereas at Discover, I can make some assumptions. I can do shorthand. I can write. I can fire off a post, knowing that I can follow up with that the next day or that night, and then I can sort of have. I can use shorthand lingo. So you do write to your different audiences.
So how long are the Slate pieces? Because the students are going to be writing some. Some students will be writing articles. I mean, just that they
anywhere between 1,000 and 2,000 words. I think they've been running.
So they're about the length of an article that you could write, and you could use those as a sort of model for the, you know, possible form of what you do. And then Carly, who is has an interest in this because she's an editor at the Daily Bruin, asks, you know, what are the benefits of presenting information or arguments in blog format?
What are the benefits to that? I obviously think there are great benefits. I've embraced blogging. I love it. I mean, I really do. The benefit is it's much more conversational. It's a breezier style. I like blogging. If you've read my Slate pieces, you know that I like to write. I have a little punchy voice, and I think that's the way you draw people in. The name of the game is you want people to read your stuff. If you're going to be a writer, the whole point is to have people read it. So that's always in my mind. The blog posts are, and I talked to John about this before. It's very conversational. I mean, I'm having a conversation with readers, and that conversation often builds on itself, and you let it sort of takes it organically develops in places that you didn't expect. So there's often an element of surprise to the blog that I really like. Like, oh, gee, that person said something that's really interesting. I'm going to put that up there and see if we can then follow that up. And so I like that. I like that whimsy. I like the whimsical quality of the blog. So I like the conversational aspect of it. But that's me.
I actually also tweeted this. For some reason, some of the tweets are lying. So I just want to let you know that.
Okay.
But, one of the questions I had was, when did you start getting more interested in, was it first your passion for the environment and these issues that came about, or journalism? Because for me, I've personally gone really into environment, like learning about the environment and environmental issues, but for me, I'm not sure if communication journalism is the route to go, or because you did policy, so how come you decided not to go into something like, you know, politics?
Actually, what I would have done when I did study at the graduate level, I was more interested in environmental history, but the degree was in policy. So I actually very, very more interested in the social science of humanities. I'm not necessarily a policy wonk. But I've had a long-standing interest in environmental topics and issues. So I think I kind of gravitated to that when I went into journalism.
Oh, now I see. And you could say your name. Who would?
Yeah, it's Michelle.
Yeah.
Marcy Brooks.
And I'm sorry I didn't. So if this happens again, remind me. I have to go back and say view all of them. See, there's a whole bunch of stuff we were missing here. Thank you. Marcy?
Marcy Brooks. When you're blogging, do you think that you're tending to think about your audio versus your visual? Because when people are going on the internet, they're generally reading it. But sometimes when I'm writing, I think of how will it look because it's going in the magazine, versus if I think that's going to be read out loud, like a speech or performance.
That's something I haven't given any thought to be honest with you. I'm only concerned. Sometimes I feel like the blog is too wordy, so I make sure to now include images or video with it because I feel like it's got to be more balanced. And now that my blog's moved over to Discover, I want it to be more.
Multi-dimensional, like you say, you think maybe you're thinking spatially
and multi-dimensional? Yeah, but I'm not worried. I think most of the people, even like the people that follow these issues, they like to read transcripts as opposed to listen. So I'm focused on the written word, definitely, but I like to have complimentary images and photos because I just think that's part of the experience. It's a pleasurable, it's nice to have some art with it. I think that's very, very important. You should consider that. I definitely think if you're going to be blogging that you want to consider adding, you know, YouTube videos, you know, links to podcasts or, you know, fun images and art because it makes it more engaging. It makes the product, the content more engaging when you have some art accompanying it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Candice. This is a little bit off topic, but how do you gain readers and advertise your blog, and how do you stand out in the blog?
How do I gain readers and stand out? You know what I think it comes down to is writing. I think sometimes you just need to be a sharp writer. Sometimes you need to develop a sharp voice. To be honest with you, I think the people that are most successful are the people that can, you know, that have a very distinctive voice and can articulate themselves. I also, to be honest with you, I don't think that's enough in these days. Though I think if you really want to make a go of it, you want to spread your word, whatever, you've got to advertise it via social media. I'm going to tell you the biggest boost that I've given my blog in the last few years in readership was going on Twitter. I honestly, I'm a late adapter to Twitter, just because I had already been on Facebook and I was blogging and I didn't have time. I just don't. you don't have so much time in the day. And so I kind of got to Twitter a little bit late. I did have my blog. I did have an automatic tweet set up. I had a Twitter feed. I had a Twitter account, but I wasn't actively Twittering. So when, every time a blog post would go up, it would just be the title. It was very static. Only when I started actively tweeting and engaging with people around the world, suddenly my audience just multiplied. Now I have readers. I have way more readers than I ever would have imagined, and from all over the world. And it's all because of Twitter. Absolutely. I have no doubt about it. Facebook wouldn't have, my friends wouldn't have done that for me on Facebook.
So here we have, I think, an important question about that. I mean, Twitter is great for what we're calling conversation, for, you know, engaging with people, for responding, for that conversation multiplying and widening out and including more and more people. But we have this, I think, an important question that, you know, conversation is the foundation, but at what point is conversation not enough? Can we say that all the talk is working?
Who can say? I mean, honestly, I mean, you just have that. You have to go on something. You have to have. I have faith that the talk leads somewhere. That we're progressing. I don't know how to measure that in terms of, like, you know, policies that are enacted. I don't. I mean, it's just, it's all mixed together now. But I do feel Twitter is very, very, very important today. Absolutely.
It's funny, I was thinking about the schism between the traditionalists and modern Greens, and I think maybe social media might be part of the schism, because I think there's something to traditional environmentalism that's like you spend time in nature and maybe not in nature. And so I think, how do you reach those people or speak to those audiences that are kind of like anti the new media?
Oh, I don't know. I think you're making an assumption that the people that are sort of very, you know, nature-y and they're not maybe as on, they're not on Twitter. I think, you know, there's a guy who wrote an article in Orion magazine that basically is, you know, aligned himself with the Unabomber. Ted Kaczynski saying, you know, yeah, this guy had it right, and he's on Twitter arguing with people about this, and the guy lives in, you know, the rural mountains of somewhere in England, but he's on Twitter. So I don't know. I think today everybody's using which of course is ironic because this guy is anti, you know, technology, saying it's corrupting, you know, the world we live in, but yet he recognizes that irony too. I don't know. I don't know how you. I think I don't know. Some people are just never going to be reached. They're just going to hold on to their views.
So since we're about communication and conversation, I think is in some ways another way of saying communication, although it implies something that I believe is increasingly important, that communication is as much about listening as it is about speaking or writing or broadcasting. I think that the conversation itself, the communication itself, at least for what we're most concerned about here in this class and in these conversations, is an important measure that success is having a good conversation. And I want to end just with one last question and ask, if you could change one thing about how we communicate about the environment, what would it be?
If I could change one thing, it's like having the genie comes to you with one wish, right? You don't want to mess it up. I think I'll go with, you know, maybe it not being so nature-centric. I think I'll go with that. I think that if we could stop being so focused on, you know, Mother Nature and balance of nature and all these sort of old ideas about how the world, you know, what we should get back to the land, and back to the wilderness. I think that's all bound up, and that that is changing. I mean, certainly the whole embrace of, you know, green urbanism and people are recognizing cities as being sustainable. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of the discourse that is moving in the right direction, I believe, in a positive direction. But I still think there's a lot of that. I would seek to change it without eliminating it, though. I want to stress that. I'm not looking to take nature out of this debate. I'm looking to maybe take it down so it's not like hovering over us. Like it's front and center.
Well, a provocative as usual, with, as some people pointed out on the Twitter stream, a strong ethos and a punchy voice, even with a conversational tone, and we're nearing the finish line here, so I hope you all join me in thanking Keith for being with us today.